Welcome to Sea of Fire Ministries with James Myers. Today, James continues our consideration of the Roman Catholic Church by discussing the papacy through a brief historical overview, beginning in the church's infancy. You can find out more about our ministry by visiting us at seaoffire.org, or you can view James's latest videos on YouTube at Sea of Fire Ministries. We hope this message serves to edify the church.
All right, as we continue our series regarding Roman Catholicism, today we are going to be looking at the papacy, in particular, papal infallibility. Now, papal infallibility as a doctrine was issued at Vatican I on July 18th, 1870, actually. Incidentally, by a vote of 533-4, so 533 yay, and 2 against. So it wasn't unanimous, but it was nearly unanimous. However, it's important for, as this is a Protestant's perspective, I think that's important to mention early on, and maybe we should have this whole time. However, as this is a Protestant perspective, I think it's incumbent on Protestants to recognize that this is a fairly recent development as far as a de fide doctrine. Now remember, de fide doctrine is basically, if you don't believe this, then you are a heretic. Okay, within the context of the Roman Catholic Church. However, also Mariology was also, we'll discuss this, but it was around this same time. So both of these are fairly recent doctrines, or developmental doctrines anyway. It's been recent where they were developed into doctrines. However, the history of the papacy and even Mariology goes back to early in the church. And so today what I want to do leading into some of what the Vatican I issued, in particular with in regards to papal infallibility, is to give a very brief historical background. Like I said, one of the interesting things about Rome and the papacy in general, but Roman Catholic Church in particular, is that obviously it originates in Rome. However, we see in the book of Acts, it begins centered in Jerusalem and concludes in Rome, where Paul is going to Rome. So this is one of the indications of the movement of the capital or the headquarters of the church from Jerusalem to Rome. Obviously, after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, Rome became even more and more important. Now, at this time, it wasn't the only church in extent, okay? However, the Roman Catholic Church believes Peter was the first bishop of the church. Now, you have to understand today, we are going to be very brief about certain things. I'd love to talk about some of the exegesis that Rome uses in regards to interpreting scripture to validate the papacy in general and the succession, this apostolic succession. However, supposedly, according to Roman church tradition, Peter was the first bishop, and then a man named Linus, and then Anacletus, and then a man named Clement of Rome. We've discussed him, and his first epistle, he was a bishop of Rome, and he wrote a letter to the Corinthians around 95 AD, okay? The dates fluctuate. Sometimes it's 93, sometimes it's 97. Some people think it was actually written during the persecution of Nero, so maybe in the 60s. That sort of thing, but historical data seems to indicate that it was later, around 95 AD. He wrote this, so we know about the two epistles in the Bible to the Corinthians. The first letter to the Corinthians from the Apostle Paul was strong and indignant. The church of Corinth was in much disarray and conflict. However, his second letter showed that they had heeded some of his warnings and some of his teachings. And so we were kind of left with bated breath to see what happened to the church in Corinth. And if for those of you who haven't read the first epistle to Clement, you're in luck. We have it. I have all the anti-Nicene fathers, Nicene, post-Nicene fathers. There are many volumes. However, he's in the first one. It's the first one written in here. I would encourage you obviously to read it. However, it's interesting, you know, if we want an indication as to how the church in Corinth responded to the second letter to the Corinthians from Paul, it didn't seem that they fared all that well. All right. So Clement's letter, however, one historian has noted that it's not written in an autocratic or tyrannical way. It's really written as a brother. It's written as a brother. However, I think this is poignant because I agree with this. It's written like a big brother. He's not being autocratic. He's not being tyrannical. He's not trying to exercise necessarily even the authority or his own authority, somewhat of his position in the elder, in the bishopric. However, remember also that in 2 Corinthians there were many schisms even in that localized church where people assumed that they were given special charismatic gifts specifically straight from God, which would usurp them over the powers of the normal church positions. Okay, and this remained. Okay, and Clement writes to them to admonish them, but to encourage them to move more and more into righteousness, to conform more and more into the image of Christ as it relates to specifically the letters that they had received from Paul. Okay, however, everything starts kind of to move to Rome. So this is one of the first indications of Rome's primacy, sort of. Okay, so you have this bishop in Rome writing to a church in Corinth, which is not in his immediate jurisdiction. In other words, let's just be clear. The bishops and the elders at this time, early on in the church history, were specific for these local locations. So their jurisdiction, so Clement's jurisdiction, was specifically Rome, okay, the city of Rome. And then you would have an elder in Jerusalem. You had an elder in Jerusalem. You'd have an elder in Constantinople. You would have an elder in Alexandria and so forth. Okay, now as time progressed, Rome, again, especially with the fall of Jerusalem, however, especially after the reign of Constantine and during the reign of Constantine, Rome was established through both ecclesiastical and politically. They were given some sort of primacy then. So moving along, even Augustine and his differences, his debates with a man named Pelagius, which we don't have time to get into. However, when they couldn't come to an agreement, they appealed to the Bishop of Rome. They appealed to Rome. And this is in North Africa. And so people are appealing to Rome sometimes, okay? Because of the cultural milieu at that time, okay? This is just, what we need to recognize is this is a gradual situation, okay? Where the eldership started in many different areas, but the prominence of Rome was very gradual, okay? Very gradual. Now, so this basically it continued to gradually increase until 1054, the Pope sent out delegates to Constantinople, really to the Eastern churches, declaring and really commanding them to accept Rome as the mother church, to which they refused. And this sparked the great schism between the Church of Rome and the Eastern Orthodox churches, a schism that remains to this day. So this isn't, you know, Protestantism isn't the first separation, in other words, from Roman Catholicism. They refused to accept Rome as the mother church. And this, so if you see, and if you notice, if you've ever looked into Eastern Orthodoxy, this has a longer history, even to the early century of the church. However, it was really after that schism where these two really became completely different entities, okay? Now, as time progressed, and there are many things, many controversies during the Middle Ages that we're not going to discuss. However, I do think it's prudent at this point, before we even consider church history, to, again, just for the Protestants to recognize that at the Protestant Reformation, the time of the Protestant Reformation, the Roman Catholic Church was probably morally more corrupt than she ever has been. Okay, than she ever has been. All right, so that's one of the kind of exceptions. Okay, now at this point, I also think it's prudent for Protestants to kind of stand in awe that this church, which began in the beginning, in the very beginning of the church, remains to this day. This church in Rome remains to this day. Whereas, where is the church of Ephesus? Where is the church of Thyatira? Where is the church of Corinth? You know, these churches that are written, that are in the Bible, are no longer there. Whereas at least a church in Rome is. I think that's a spectacular point in church history specifically, which again, I just think Protestants ought to respect and acknowledge. One of the things I think is prudent also is to recognize that the Protestant Reformation, again, was just that. It was a reformation. The reformers, the Protestants, all link our history to the churches and to the original church doctrines. And again, the instrument, the material cause of the Reformation was justification. The formal cause was authority. So that's kind of what we're talking about today with the papacy, you know, his authority. Does it usurp the scriptures and so forth? However, again, this was one of the underlying situations at the time. It wasn't so obvious. The main crux of the issue was justification. And obviously the reformers believe that the instrumental cause is faith, sola fide. However, we all come from the same lineage, so to speak. And I think that's prudent to recognize. We are not, I've seen comparisons with Protestants to like the Church of Latter-day Saints or Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses. And that's not even not fair. That's not historically accurate. That's not accurate in any respect. And as we go along, we'll see some other schisms and some other separations from the Church of Rome. However, so as time passed, after this schism, again, this was a gradual increase. Now, in 1860, Victor Emmanuel II, the King of Italy at that time, conquered the papacy, in essence, conquered the Church of Rome, and many of the papal lands, many of the papal states, okay, at this time, to which he was summarily excommunicated. You know, the Pope issued his bull of excommunication, and Victor Emmanuel didn't really take that any seriously. He didn't take that with any seriousness. Basically took the bull, and he took the lands, and that was it. You know, however, he was excommunicated. And so in June of 1846, this is when Pius IX was elected into the papacy. And he began the longest papacy ever, 32 years. He was a pope for 32 years. That is a very long period of time. Now, before this took place, there were basically two philosophical trends that were leading up to this point, okay? One is called Gallicanism. Anybody tell me what Gallicanism is? All right, this actually goes back to the 13th century, okay? But Gallicanism takes its name from Gaul, which we all associate with France, right? Anyway, which we all associate with France. Now, Gallicanism wanted an independent state outside of the authority of Rome. And we have to understand the separation of church and state was not a thing at this point, okay? So they wanted their own independence, okay? And this had a gradual change in emphasis as well, where Gallicanism was specific, at that time anyway, regarding independence from Rome specifically. However, this moved and spread out into many different political trends wanting independence. As we know, in our nation specifically, we took that and we gained our own independence, and we do have what's called the separation of church and state, which we might speak to very passively today. The other one was called Ultramontanism. Okay, Ultramontanists accepted and believed in the authority of Rome. They wanted to remain under the authority of Rome. Now, Ultramontanist just means on the other side of the mountains. So they were on the other side of the Alps, okay? But they were fine with Roman rule, so to speak. So you have Gallicanism and you have Ultramontanism, okay? Now, when Pius IX is elected Pope, he's considered somewhat liberal at this point. Definitely not an Ultramontanist, but he's considered somewhat liberal at this point. And he wanted to pass some reforms, some changes, so to speak, which all failed. And he seemed to go through something like a personal crisis, certainly something of an intellectual crisis. And he started passing encyclicals without consulting the bishops or the College of Cardinals, okay? One was regarding the Immaculate Conception as a De Fide doctrine. So the Immaculate Conception of Mary was passed without any consent by the councils and so forth. And again, this is just to tell you in passing, just to show you his gradual autocratic reign. Okay, we'll discuss this, God willing, next week regarding Mary anyway. He also issued the Syllable of Errors, which denounced and condemned all sorts of isms. You had liberalism, you had evolution, you had naturalism, the separation of church and state. You know, he denounced and condemned those who would have a separation of church and state, and specifically Protestantism. Very strongly condemned Protestantism at this time. So again, we looked at last week where at Vatican I there was a gradual, like we had mentioned, Pius IX actually did want some sort of reconciliation between the Protestants and the Catholics. However, I did try to make it clear that this was, you know, a fairly modified version. You know, he wasn't determined absolutely to bring these into union. Basically, he wanted, remember, the issue was, what do we do now with the second generation, in other words, of Protestants and so forth. So he still strongly condemned Protestantism, okay? So now, at Vatican I, what he wanted to do and what the council wanted to do was set this into doctrine, make sense, in other words, and also establish it as a De Fide doctrine. And that happened at the fourth session at the First Vatican Council, okay, on July 18th, 1870. And let's take a look at that council. I'm going to give you somewhat brief parts of this. It's really the conclusions of these parts. There are four chapters with an introduction, and so we're going to take bits and pieces out of these, but there's more to it. There's not much more to it, but these are all readily available online, should you choose. So, in the introduction, the First Dogmatic Constitution on the Church of Christ says, quote, "And since the gates of hell trying, if they can, to overthrow the Church, make their assault with a hatred that increases day by day against this divinely laid foundation, we judge it necessary, with the approbation of the Sacred Council and for the protection, defense, and growth of the Catholic flock, to propound the doctrine concerning the institution, permanence, and nature of the sacred and apostolic primacy, upon which the strength and coherence of the whole Church depends. This doctrine is to be believed and held by all the faithful in accordance with the ancient and unchanging faith of the whole Church. Furthermore, we shall prescribe and condemn the contrary errors which are so harmful to the Lord's flock." So this, specifically, these terms, believe and held. Now, you'll notice in certain councils, they'll issue a doctrine that is to be held. And many, you know, theologians have a tendency to make distinctions, okay? This is the, you know, prerogative of the theologian. So it's one thing to hold to a certain doctrine. Basically, you know, these people would say, okay, fine, I'll hold to this doctrine. I'll even teach it. I'll even teach it, and I'll hold on to this doctrine. It's a whole other thing to ask me to believe it, okay? This is commanding, as a de fide doctrine, to believe it as well, okay? Very much stronger than just being held. Now, there are basically three main topics, in other words, regarding this specific session, okay? That the papacy is Petrine, so it derives its authority through the succession which was given to Peter. They see Peter as the greatest of the apostles. He had primacy over all of the apostles. And again, without getting into the exegesis that they use to extrapolate that, they see Peter as the greatest of the apostles. Okay, and so the Pope's authority derives from Peter. Also, this is a perpetual succession without any end. Okay, this is a perpetual succession, and it is Roman. So these are the three main topics which we'll see through reading these. However, it's Petrine, it's perpetual, and it's Roman. Okay, but these are to be believed and held. Okay, going on chapter 1, on the institution of the apostolic primacy in Blessed Peter. Therefore, if anyone says, so we've also noticed at other councils, in particular since we consider the Council of Trent, that one is to issue doctrines and then others are to condemn errors, which we will see. Remember, let him be anathema, let him be accursed. You know, if you don't believe this, let him be accursed. And that's what this follows as well. Therefore, if anyone says that Blessed Peter the Apostle was not appointed by Christ the Lord as Prince of all the Apostles and visible head of the whole church militant, or that it was a primacy of honor only and not one of true and proper jurisdiction that he directly and immediately received from our Lord Jesus Christ himself, let him be anathema. So this one goes into the primacy of Peter. He's the Prince of all the Apostles according to Rome. Very quickly, the Protestants do see Peter was something of a leader of the other apostles. That couldn't be more clear. However, again, with the time that we have, we just can't get into this too much, okay? However, so this is establishing the primacy of Peter, which again, will have a perpetual succession. Chapter 2, on the permanence of the primacy of the Blessed Peter in the Roman pontiffs. Therefore, if anyone says that it is not by the institution of Christ the Lord himself, that is to say, by divine law, that Blessed Peter should have perpetual successors in the primacy over the whole church, or that the Roman pontiff is not the successor of Blessed Peter in this primacy, let him be anathema. So again, this is just the perpetual succession. If you don't believe that this is a perpetual succession to be found in the papacy, let him be accursed. Okay. Chapter 3, on the power and character of the primacy of the Roman pontiff. If anyone says that the Roman pontiff has merely an office of supervision and guidance, and not the full and supreme power of jurisdiction over the whole church, and this not only in matters of faith and morals, but also in those which concern the discipline and government of the church dispersed throughout the whole world, or that he has only the principal part, but not the absolute fullness of this supreme power, or that this power of his is not ordinary and immediate both over all and each of the churches, and over all and each of the pastors and faithful, let him be anathema. So this isn't just that he's infallible or supreme or of primacy as it relates to doctrines of regarding faith and morals, but also government. So again, this is not just an ecclesiastical power, it's a political power as well. It's a political authority. Let's use the word authority, okay? It's an ecclesiastical authority, and it's a political authority. Lastly and finally, chapter 4, on the infallible teaching authority of the Roman pontiff. We teach and define as a divinely revealed dogma that when the Roman pontiff speaks ex cathedra, or ex cathedra, that is, when in the exercise of his office as shepherd and teacher of all Christians, in virtue of his supreme apostolic authority, he defines a doctrine concerning faith or morals to be held by the whole church. He possesses, by the divine assistance promised to him in Blessed Peter, that infallibility which the divine Redeemer willed his church to enjoy in defining doctrine concerning faith or morals. Therefore, such definitions of the Roman pontiffs are of themselves and not by the consent of the church irreformable. So then, should anyone, which God forbid, have the temerity to reject this definition of ours, let him be anathema. So, one of the things, okay, there's much loaded in this conclusion, okay? Basically, this is saying, when the pontiff speaks I pronounce it ex cathedra because I'm a Texan, okay? So it's ex cathedra. This is basically out of the chair. This is out of the seat of Peter, whose four legs stand on the four corners of the earth, okay? The four corners of the world. So it's speaking out of the authority, out of the chair, at ex cathedra. So when he speaks ex cathedra, this is infallible, okay? Now, incidentally, this council was interrupted because Victor Emmanuel invaded Rome, and so this council was interrupted, so they weren't able to tie up loose ends regarding is the pope infallible ex cece, so out of himself, is this an intrinsic infallibility, okay, or is it merely regarding faith and morals, or and should it be in accordance with and with a in partnership with the councils and the cardinals and the bishops and so forth? It leaves it fairly ambiguous, okay? And we don't have time to get into much of Vatican II. So let me just kind of give you some somewhat snippets regarding this. However, specifically after this, there were different reactions, okay? One of the great German theologian at the time, the Roman Catholic theologian at the time, Dollinger, okay, because I'm not going to pronounce it Dollinger or however it's supposed to be pronounced. However, he renounced this. He completely dismissed this and refused to believe it, and he was excommunicated. There was a group that didn't, you know, separated because they wouldn't accept this part specifically, papal infallibility and the authority of the papacy in this, to this extent. In all other respects, they were Roman, okay, and they became to be known as the Old Catholic Church, which generally speaking is predominantly in Germany, Switzerland, Holland, and Austria. So outside of those areas, this really isn't prominent. By 1950, there were about 100,000 members of this Old Catholic Church. Incidentally, I also think it's prudent to mention for Protestants or anybody in particular that there are over 1 billion Roman Catholics in the world. But the last estimate I saw was 1.3 billion people are Roman Catholics. There are 1.3 billion Roman Catholics in the world. That's a good chunk of a population of the world, which consists of about 8 billion. Okay. So, two different reactions. Okay. But then some, completely accepting this, went a little further in their interpretation and really compared his infallibility to that with God. And essentially, the Pope is intrinsically infallible. Now, the Council never said this. The Council never said this. I just think it's prudent, again, since this is a Protestant perspective, I think the tendency is for our time to believe that what we are remonstrating against, what we are protesting, is the papacy and Mariology. These were fairly recent developments. The reformers weren't dealing with this. I mean, they would speak against the Pope very strongly, even calling him the Antichrist, which carried over into different councils. And again, we don't have time to get into that because there's much in that, and there are reasons for that. Luther, okay, nope, I'm not going to do that. Okay, you almost got me on a rabbit trail. However, So there are these different reactions, completely different reactions, okay? However, one, also, Otto von Bismarck, he was the chancellor of Germany. In 1872, he was passing these policies that the bishops in Germany didn't care for. And they implored him to change these policies. And he refused, calling them hirelings. You have no power. You're just a hireling. Obviously, they weren't too happy with that. And they would tell him, we speak out of the authority given straight to us from Jesus Christ. Straight from Jesus Christ, okay? And the Pope, Pius IX, did issue a statement saying that that's absolutely right. Now, this was not, again, the council didn't get to settle these loose ends. So Vatican II took these up, okay? And remember, we also remember the different moods of Vatican I and Vatican II. Vatican I was sort of reactionary, okay? This was, given all the things that were surrounding it, you know, they're being invaded, and you also have secular theologians, as we talked about, Hans Küng. He was very much speaking against the papacy in this respect, especially in regards to the infallibility and the authority. He saw it really stemming because Rome was a strong government after Constantine. This went into the church and carried over this empirical, basically, dominion. Okay. So you have these issues going on, and so this is reactionary. Vatican II, as we talked about, was conciliatory. It was a conciliatory deal. Also, incidentally, going back to Pius IX, because I just think this is kind of cool, just because of my background, a man named Guido was against this idea of papal infallibility and spoke strongly against it. And he asked Pope Pius IX, what about tradition? And Pius IX famously said, why is that so hard to say? Said, I am the tradition. Now, right, that's kind of pompous. However, I grew up with Rambo, you know, the Terminator. I just think that's kind of cool. I could just see him with sunglasses. You know, apologies to my Catholic brothers and sisters, but I don't mean to be, you know, demeaning. I just think that's kind of cool. He's got his shades on. I am tradition. I just think that's cool. Now, so Vatican II was generally remembered to bring in, the Protestants were allowed to attend. They weren't allowed to vote, but they were allowed to attend, okay? And remember, in Vatican I, Protestants were referred to as schismatics and heretics. In Vatican II, they were referred to as separated brethren, okay? So obviously, a very softer mood, okay? But they were also called to reconcile this issue that, again, Vatican I didn't have time or the chance to. Specifically in the Lumen Gentium, which is the light of the nations, they spoke mostly about this papal infallibility, and especially in regards to the bishops. Let me just give you a brief synopsis because we're running out of time. So remember, Peter has the primacy over all of the apostles. And so essentially what they said that it was that the bishops also derived their authority from all the other apostles. So there is a succession of the other apostles as well, but the papacy, the Pope specifically, derives him from Peter, the prince of the apostles. Okay. Now that's just, so some of the implications of this. The papacy, the infallibility, I just think this is important for Protestants to recognize, and Roman Catholics. The infallibility of the Pope is not intrinsic. He's not intrinsically infallible. In other words, he's only infallible as it relates to doctrines of faith and morals and the government and ecclesiology of the church. Let me just put it that way. If you were to ask Pope Francis for directions to the nearest airport, you shouldn't expect that he's going to infallibly give you perfect directions if he doesn't know the city and if he doesn't know the roads. In other words, outside of his infallibility as it relates to faith and morals and the government of the church, he is not infallible. He derives his infallibility from, so he is called the head of the church, but we also have to understand they recognize Christ is the head of the church. But basically, the Pope is the head, is Christ's representative as the head of the church on earth. Okay, so he's not intrinsically infallible. I think that's important to point out, and I think that's important for us to recognize and appreciate. Okay, I think the tendency, again, going back to what I've said before, is to cast stones without ever considering what you're throwing at, or at which you're throwing. Okay, so Papal infallibility was a gradual doctrine, okay? Now, again, it's a fairly recent development, but for the greatest part of church history, it was believed by many, it was assumed by many, and it was accepted by possibly still more, okay? But it wasn't set into doctrine until fairly recently, and this provoked other schisms. And again, going back to the schism, the great schism between the Eastern Orthodox churches and the church in Rome in 1054 was derivative of this same presumption of primacy. Okay. Now, very briefly, in the very little bit of time that I have, this is essentially why I can't be a Roman Catholic. I love the history of the church, and we share much in common. We share most of the history, if not the entire history. But if I'm accursed because I don't accept the infallibility, or this, in my opinion, poor hermeneutical exegesis to derive this authority out of Scripture, then I'm accursed. One theologian, because I think this puts it perfectly, suggests that the Roman Catholic Church interprets the Bible a posteriori this way. So in other words, they see the tradition of Rome and so forth, and they infuse that into the Bible, where a priori is just taking it straight out of the Bible. To put it very simply, this, remember, goes back to epistemology and so forth. However, I do have to say very briefly, but I didn't get the chance to actually seek more information about this, to be fair. But one of the books that I got regarding one of the books that I bought regarding the papacy from a Roman apologist perspective, chapter 3 was on epistemology. I was very excited. I love epistemology. I'm something of a philosopher for many, many years, as most of you know. So I was very excited about this. And what I found was a lot of circular reasoning. What began with an exegesis with certain select parts of the Bible, with leaving certain things out that would have given greater context, and using, there are two Greek words for power or authority, okay? Exousia, which is really authority, that's essentially authority, but sometimes it's translated power, and dynamis, which is power. So when Christ had power to heal, it could be authority as well, but these are not so interchangeable. However, one of the verses that he had given, used dynamis, and he used it in the context of exousia as authority, which would be fine if you would have included the first part of this verse, when you are gathered in the name of Jesus Christ. When you leave that out, you take the whole context out. And then it was what I found to be much circular reasoning, pointing to the catechism of the Catholic Church to authorize these things. I mean, you're basically saying the reason these are authoritative is because the church says they're authoritative. Essentially is what I saw out of this treatise on the epistemology regarding the papacy specifically. So, however, I do think it's prudent also to recognize how much we have in common, okay? Just because I wouldn't be accepted into the Roman Catholic Church, and there are other things that we've discussed that I wouldn't conscientiously be okay with going to a mass. We've discussed these things, okay? However, this church, the Roman See, so to speak, the Roman Church, is still under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And the Protestants must know this. We must not talk about the Roman Catholic Church like we do Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormonism or Islam and so forth. They are our brothers and sisters. I believe, within the visible church, who knows? Who knows? But I firmly believe, on account of what Christ said, that there are many within the invisible church in the visible church at Rome. This is not a heretical situation. Much of the doctrines, I think are. However, there were some great popes, just so you know. Leo the Great was fantastic. Gregory the Great was fantastic. I don't know if you know about this, but when Attila the Hun was invading Rome, it was Leo the Great who met him at the gates and dissuaded him from this. Very sweet episode, which, again, you can read if you'd like. But, so, we just have to understand the context of this, of the historical background leading into many of these things that divide us sometimes and really have no reconciliation. However, a reconciliation is found in Jesus Christ. And we must never lose sight of that. I think Protestants have a tendency to see Rome as a heretical church, and Roman Catholic Church, by doctrine, certainly sees the Protestants as heretical. But I believe brothers and sisters within the church don't see it this way. I've encountered some that are very amiable and wonderful to speak to. Wonderful to speak to. They're not condemning, and we can have a conversation, a thoughtful dialogue. I think this is what we need. I think this is what we need within the Protestant community. I think this is what we need within the Catholic community. I think this is what we need within the Catholic and the Protestant community. To at least, again, there are many things that cannot be reconciled, most likely. But what can be reconciled is that we are both under the Lordship of Jesus Christ. That's our central situation. He is the true head of the church. And whoever the Father has given him, he will in no way lose. Catholic, Protestant, or otherwise. There might be someone who celebrates Kwanzaa or something. That may very well be under the headship of Jesus Christ, and we just don't know it. Many of these popes will have to answer to him. There was much degradation for a long period of time, which Rome acknowledges. Okay, so I'm not speaking out of turn here. However, these were somewhat of the exceptions. Rome has had, again, I think it's somewhat awe-inspiring that she is the only church that originated, whose origin is from the first century, in the beginning of the churches. Okay, so these other things notwithstanding, I hope to bring some of these things to the fore in our series regarding church history, but for now, it's going to have to wait till then. All right. Praise God.
Thank you for listening to Sea of Fire Ministries. We hope and pray this has blessed you in your walk with God, and we hope you join us again next week. You have been listening to Sea of Fire Ministries, where the Word of God is life.